Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour, stories and articles about the American West, produced at the Recording Library of West Texas. Your narrator is Jack.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading some articles from the November-December issue of Cowboys and Indians magazine. Schaefer Outfitter. The authentic outdoor life requires authentic outdoor apparel. And the folks at Texas-based Schaefer Outfitter have you covered for Land for Life by Lindsay Welchel. Waking up with the sun and stepping outside to start the day, no matter the weather, takes a special kind of person. Maybe you're a cowboy or cowgirl riding the range, a farmer starting up your tractor, or an avid outdoor person embracing the beauty of Mother Nature while hiking, fishing, or hunting. Braving the elements to tackle the day also takes a special kind of wardrobe. And for 40 years now, a hard day's work has been made easier by the highly functional clothes on the backs of Schaefer Outfitter customers. Most of our customers are working outdoors, says Schaefer Outfitter CEO and President Jason Smith. We have a 40-year history of standing the test of time, weathering the elements, and being the preferred outdoor wear garment for someone that's going to spend 10 or more hours outside. Weather can change at the drop of a hat. We're the piece that they're putting on that is going to protect them and service them throughout the day. Over those 40 years, customers living a Western way of life have built up a strong emotional connection to the brand, in large part due to its commitment to authenticity and performance. Schaefer items are often bought as rites of passage for ranching children or handed down through generations. This relationship with customers quickly became apparent to Smith when he recently took the helm at Schaefer from longtime leader Rick Grant, who retired earlier this year. Started by Cub Schaefer in 1982, Schaefer Outfitter quickly made a name for itself with apparel that met the practical needs of people living and working outdoors. It became especially popular for its duster, the iconic full-length coat synonymous with a rugged Marlboro Man persona. After thriving through the 80s, the company hit a downturn, and in the early 1990s it was bought by a group of investors out of Steamboat Springs, Colorado. The group asked Grant to come in to turn the company's trajectory around, and that's exactly what he did. Alongside his wife, Lynn, Grant led Schaefer as president and eventually owner for most of the next two decades. A regular at the Western and English Sales Association trade show, Schaefer largely focused on wholesale business until the company introduced a thriving mail-order catalog pipeline for direct-to-consumer sales. Grant's secret was to focus on quality and authenticity. Everything has a meaning, he says. Every product has a story. Why it was done that way. Why it was made the way it was. That intentionality led the way for growth. The company developed performance-based offerings such as the popular Range Wax and Range Tech lines. The brand also invested in building quality relationships with pillars of the Western community, such as Red Steagall, and more recently with the Four Sixes Ranch, and outfitting stars of the hit television drama Yellowstone, as well as a new partnership with the team at Taylor Sheridan's Bosque Ranch. These efforts helped solidify Schaefer's visibility and reputation among outdoors people and caught the attention of Robert Clay, a rancher and real estate developer in Houston. Clay fell in love with Schaefer and wanted to be a part of the brand's story in whatever way he could. That dream materialized in 2006 when he befriended Grant in Steamboat Springs and then embarked on a campaign to purchase Schaefer from him. They finalized the deal in 2014, and Grant stayed on as president of the company. Eventually, Schaefer headquarters relocated to Fort Worth, Texas, and where the company now has a destination retail store in the famous historic Stockyards. Clay and Grant sought to equip Schaefer with an all-star staff to navigate the brand after Grant's retirement. It meant a lot to me to see the new team that's taking our place really is going to be a steward of the brand, Grant says. These guys really get it and are really into the history of what we've done, maintaining the brand legacy and taking it to the next level, because it's ready. It's what I call a 40-year-old racehorse. It never lost its luster. It's great to just be in the know of a brand like this, Clay says. It is about Western heritage, keeping that alive and making it a brand that's real, not a contrived one or somebody trying to be something they're not. I don't think there's any other brand that has coordinated and put together everything for Western heritage like we've done, and we're very proud of that. We've got 40 years of great foundation and storytelling. That's authenticity that you can't buy, so that makes my life easier, Smith says. It's not me out in the wild rubbing two sticks together. Rick has built up this beautifully warm fire. My job is to take that fire and grow it. This is a 40-year-old growth company. This team is excited to introduce Schaefer Outfitter to an entirely new generation of caretakers and people who have a special relationship with the brand. And the timing is right, he assures. Call it COVID, call it Yellowstone phenomenon, but Americana, getting outside, getting back in touch with nature, the land, those themes have really become prevalent over the last 2 to 3 years. And this brand exists at those intersections and experiences. The team also includes Director of Brand and Creative Chris Wiley. For land, for life. That's our unifying mission. That's our brand ethos, our North Star, Wiley says. It's purpose-built garments for the people who live and work by the land. Ranchers, farmers, anyone in our agriculture, anglers, hunters, their passions and pursuits involve the land. Everything is built around usability and fit. Our apparel hits that fit the first time almost every time. Besides that fit, it's also the materials and the longevity of the apparel that keeps customers coming back. They know they can expect durability and functionality from Schaefer every single time. Focusing on innovations to the apparel is Johnny Townsend, head of product. She grew up in the Western lifestyle and comes from a performance apparel background. My point of view on apparel is that clothes are meant to be worn, she says. They're not just clothes you wear for a couple of hours a day. These are not things you maybe pull on out of the closet once every couple of months. These are the clothes you spend your life in, sun up to sundown, when you're up at 4 a.m. and getting to work. The focus is really on performance. Townsend is a vintage apparel aficionado and draws on Schaefer's past while looking toward the future. We want to continue to provide all the old-school, heavy-duty technology around the cotton canvas, wax, and carry it forward, because that's part of our foundation. But we're also focused on introducing new technology that's been developed in the modern era of lightweight performance shirting that has UPF protection, antimicrobial protection, that has the stretch, and the breathability. We want to make life easier. We want to make it more comfortable. We want to support all aspects of what our customers do. The Western way of life goes even deeper than types of occupation at Schaefer, Smith says. In terms of a hard day's work and getting what you paid for, a handshake being a handshake, people being beholden to their word, there are some basic fundamental principles the cowboy code that surround the lifestyle that a lot of us could really benefit from if we thought about what that code really means, which is showing kindness and respect toward each other. As Schaefer, we want to be a kind brand, and we want to be a respectful brand. What they're striving for at Schaefer Outfitter, Smith says, goes back to being out on the land and living the authentic Western life. I am most at peace when I'm out in the grandness of nature, he says. It's that deep feeling the brand is hoping to preserve and inspire for 40 more years.
Hello, this is Michael, and I am reading articles from the November 2022 edition of True West Magazine, History of the American Frontier. This article is the cover article from the November edition, Hellraisers and Trailblazers, by Jana Bommersbach and Bob Bowes-Bell. The Real Women of the Wild West, the Queen of the Colorado Red Light District. Jenny Rogers was a tall drink of water, as they used to say, standing at 6 feet tall. She had gone through several names and marriages before she landed in Denver, wearing her trademark pair of emerald earrings. She purchased her first house from Maddie Silks in 1880. At 1942 Market Street, she opened the House of Mirrors, which was known as the most opulent and infamous brothel in Denver. She became notorious and even better known when she caught her husband in the arms of another woman several months after their wedding in 1887. I shot him because I love him, damn him, she is quoted as telling the police. Her wounded husband persuaded the authorities to let her go. Death on the line. Wyatt Earp arrived in Tombstone with his second wife, Maddie, who he later abandoned for the live-in girlfriend of Johnny Behan. Maddie returned to her former profession as a soiled dove and ended up in Pinal, Arizona, where she took an overdose of laudanum on July 3, 1888, per her grave marker. Before she died, she confessed, "Wyatt Earp ruined my life." The notorious Sadie Marcus. A teenage runaway, Sadie, real name Josephine Marcus, landed in Tombstone and shacked up with Cochise County Sheriff Johnny Behan. By 1881, that relationship was over, and she later consummated an affair with Behan's arch-rival, Wyatt Earp. She lived with Earp for 47 years as a common-law wife and outlived him by nearly 16 years. Much like Libby Custer did for her famous husband, George Armstrong, Marcus fiercely protected Earp's reputation. She also tried to cover up her own infamous past in Tombstone. Historians still debate whether or not she had worked as a soiled dove. Did Big Nose Kate have a big nose? One of the enduring mysteries of the Old West history is, where did Doc Holliday's girlfriend, Kate Elder, real name Mary Catherine Haroney, get her nickname? Some say she got it because she couldn't keep her nose out of other people's business. She was nosy. The earliest mention of the nickname is found in Wyatt Earp's article in the San Francisco Examiner, August 2, 1896, how Wyatt Earp routed a gang of Arizona outlaws. In the article, it's plain that Wyatt had no use for Kate, and the feeling was mutual. But here's the rub. No contemporary document or newspaper item has been found that described her as Big Nose Kate. Many historians have made the case that in the photographs of her in old age, she doesn't appear to have a big proboscis. But if you look closely, that is not a button nose. At this late date, the verdict is still out. But if push comes to shove, we think you could make a case that she, indeed, had a big honker. At a place, the beautiful girlfriend of the Sundance Kid followed the Kid and Butch Cassidy to South America. She appeared in the famous Tea Party photo taken at Cholula, Argentina, but she disappeared sometime before the boys met their doom in Bolivia. Some accounts state that she was a school teacher, but most historians now believe she was actually working in Fanny Porter's brothel in San Antonio when Harry Lagerbaug met her in about 1899. Even her exotic name, Etta, is now thought to have been a typo on a Pinkerton rap sheet and perhaps a corruption of Ethel. Either way, she is now a legendary Old West character. When Charlotte Hall pulled a gun on Grover Cleveland. Okay, it wasn't that Grover Cleveland. It's August of 1911, and Charlotte Hall is again exploring Arizona territory, this time in the Marsh Pass area near Tuba City. An Indian runner finds her and delivers her a telegram that her beloved mother is in the Prescott Hospital. To get to her, Charlotte must intercept the Winslow train. She commandeers a buckboard and a Navajo guide named Grover Cleveland for an all-night dash across roadless terrain, and then was hindered by a violent storm that turned normally dry washes into raging torrents. When Grover refused to cross the swirling water, a most practical and responsible decision, Charlotte pulled a gun on him and demanded they go on. She met the train and got to her mother's bedside. Later, she told her good friend, Alice Hewins of Phoenix, she did not know which he was more afraid of, the road or Charlotte. Stagecoach Mary. She had the temperament of a grizzly bear. She was tough, but not with children. She was bawdy. She was hard drinking and quick shooting, and she loved her guns. Still, she was adored by the community who knew her as Stagecoach Mary. Biddy Mason. She was 29 years old, had already endured rape, had three daughters, and knew this was her life forever. And then she was forced to walk with the wagon train 2,000 miles west, and everything changed. Lozen. She was born in the Chihin Chiricahua Apache Band in their spiritual home of Ojo Caliente, between what's now Silver City and Socorro in New Mexico. Like all Apache children, she was trained in the skills of survival, with girls as well as boys, learning to fight, hunt, and ride. But while most girls then went on to marry and raise families, Lozen rejected that role. Instead, she trained as a warrior, like her older brother. The Queen of the Santa Fe Tidbits. Las Tulas won many a Monte game because of her distracting beauty and her ability to read the minds of the men she played against. Soldaderas. Some went into battle wearing long peasant skirts, large straw hats, and a cross bullet belt. Some dressed as men, knowing generals like Pancho Villa resented them. But that didn't stop these soldaderas, these heroines of the Mexican Revolution. They are romanticized under the popular name Adelita, from a former folk song of the Revolution. Petra Pedro Herrera, Angela Angel Jimenez, Amelia Emilio Robles Avila. These women stood out. They all dressed as men and all rose through the ranks of the armies of Zapata, Venustiano Carranza, and even Pancho Villa. Many other soldaderas never saw battle, but played an even more crucial role, joining their men and providing the life support that kept the armies going, finding and cooking food, nursing the wounded. Dilch. She started out her escape journey with two other captives, but they were soon captured. Her meager rations quickly ran out, and she had to subsist on seeds and cactus fruit. She couldn't swim, and yet she got across the Colorado River. She didn't have a map, but she made it to the White Mountains. Chalk it all up to being an Apache. Stubborn, resilient, and resourceful. Amazing. A doomed wagon train. The Oatmans began their ill-fated journey on a wagon train that had some 93 members riding or walking beside 43 wagons bound for the land of Bashan, today known as Yuma. Petty infighting, alternative visions, and illnesses took their toll. So much so that by the time they reached Socorro, New Mexico, their ranks had been cut in half. And by the time they reached the Gila River on the west of the Big Bend in Arizona Territory, the wagons had been reduced to only one. The tragedy that ensued and the captivity of the Oatman girls is re-examined and new truths are revealed. The Great Western. They called her the Great Western, after the largest ship then on the sea. She went through a whole variety of names over a lifetime of multiple husbands. A signature piece in the book is this cascading collage of encapsulating and reflecting the real women of the Wild West experience. The book and the art show will premiere on November 4th, 2022 at the Phippen Art Museum in Prescott, Arizona. True West Magazine, November 2022. Tumbling Dice, Blind Pigs, and Brothels by Don Chaput and David DeHaas. The ERP's last stand in Los Angeles was more bust than bonanza. In 1866, the first home for disabled war veterans was opened in Togus, Maine. And not long thereafter, more veterans' homes opened in various locations around the Midwest and eastern United States. By the mid-1880s, the need for a comparable home on the West Coast was recognized, and the search was on. In 1875, Santa Monica, California had been founded, and the first private residences were sold there. Future Tombstone, Arizona ERP icon, the silver-tongued orator, and legendary ERP OK Corral defense attorney, Thomas Fitch, was on hand as the featured speaker at the July 1875 city launch party. In the 1890s, another Tombstone notable, Tombstone Weekly Epitaph newspaper owner-editor and tourist promoter, S.C. Bagg, would become an active participant in the home sales there. There was vast open space between the cities of Los Angeles and Santa Monica, and in 1888, after intense negotiations, a property deed was recorded, and construction initiated on a new Pacific branch of the National Home of Disabled Volunteer Soldiers, Los Angeles County, California, a.k.a. the Old Soldiers Home, about 3 miles west of Santa Monica and 12 miles west of Los Angeles. In 1897, the first lot was sold in the newly developing town of Sawtelle, which abutted the Soldiers Home. Many veterans and their families purchased lands in Sawtelle to be near relatives living there. The problem was the sale of alcohol was prohibited by law within 3 miles of the Soldiers' Home. The ERPs invade. Enter the ERP family in the first decade of the 20th century with their illicit gambling and alcohol sales, a.k.a. blind pig bootlegging scheme, and lifelong experiences as law officers, saloon and brothel owners, operators, and professional gamblers. It was their final attempt together as a family, to obtain the big profits they had been pursuing about the country their entire lives. The newly emerging Santa Monica Sawtill area was to be their final shot at a major bonanza, and it would involve all the surviving members of the Earp family, including their patriarch, Nicholas. Blind Pigs, Sunshine, and Santa Monica. The local newspapers frequently stated that evil men were standing at the gates of the soldiers' home, taking advantage of these veterans, grabbing their pension money. The reality was that the veterans enjoyed going to Sawtell and having a good time. Furthermore, many of the villains castigated by the press were veterans. Some of the leading entertainment providers in Sawtell were James Earp, John Dupree, and P.J. Flynn. All three were Civil War veterans, residents of Sawtell, and in good standing with their soldiers' home buddies. Some, like James Earp, even had relatives living in the home. The Sawtell area soldiers' home differed in many ways from other institutions for veterans. The population was huge. It was of recent origin, and the community adjacent to it only came into existence because of the home. And in an unusual development, those individuals most involved in organizing the card rooms, blind pigs, and whorehouses were themselves veterans, residents either of the home or of nearby Sawtell. The soldiers' home, Pacific Branch, became a tourist site, well-positioned on the famous balloon route, the interurban that took passengers from Los Angeles locations to Santa Monica, with a stop along the way to pose with military-clothed veterans at various home buildings. In this era, the soldiers' home was well-known nationally, praised for its fine buildings, extensive grounds, gardens, and farm, and for its efficient hospital and other facilities. A typical instance for the far and wide impact of the home occurred in 1913, when the Arizona Republican reported that Civil War veteran Elias N. Pegg had just left Arizona for the home in Sawtell for an eye operation, journeying the long distance due to its reputation for exceptional medical care. The home was frequently featured in photographs carried in the local press as well as in regional and national magazines. This important institution, though, was adjacent to Sawtell, which led to the following assertion in the California Journal of Assembly. "The most pitiful sight in all the Southland today is not the soldier's home, a splendid series of fine mansions surrounded by a magnificent park and beautiful gardens, but the town of Sawtell beside it, where many of the wives and daughters of the old, well-cared-for veterans eke out a miserable existence in old shacks and tumble-down structures, taking in washing for a living, or running blind pigs, and otherwise ministering to the animal desires of some of the male pigs, some of these same old favored wards of the nation." Tumbling dice in Sawtell. The Battle of Sawtell was not a street fight, nor a man-on-man duel with drawn revolvers. The newspapers, though, almost every time an Earp was mentioned, used words like notorious and gunfighter, and peppered most stories with references to Tombstone and other examples of frontier violence. The battle for the Earps was to see how big a slice of the huge federal pension fund could come their way. Many were in on their game, and the Earps hoped that their decades of prowling the mining boom towns of the West, operating the card games, whorehouses, and saloons, as well as often being cloaked with authority as lawmen and justices, would give them an edge in the environment of Sawtell, where thousands of veterans were bored and thirsty and had some spare pension money to take care of these problems. As a reminder of what was at stake, In the fiscal year 1908, which had ended a few months previously, $567,985 was distributed to home veterans, most receiving between $6 and $20 a month. That was a lot of money, and certain operators in Sawtelle determined that it shouldn't go farther than the card rooms and blind pigs of 4th Street. Nicholas was most likely the cause of the move to Sawtelle by the Earps. He and James had to have had that conversation, because shortly after James moved to from San Francisco to Sawtelle, Nick was enrolled in the soldiers' home. Justice Earp was probably one of the best known of the 1,000-plus veterans in the home, and his forceful, outgoing manner must have been important in shifting clientele toward the 4th Street card room of his son James. James knew that he could count on Nicholas, and to a lesser extent, his older half-brother Newton on the inside, to steer traffic toward his 4th Street venue. For a year or so, Virgil had lent his presence and his name toward the Sawtelle purse, but then he had moved on to Nevada, leaving James to head the Earp interests. Virgil's death in 1905 was not only a blow to the Earp family, but meant that there would be no return to Sawtelle for him. Shortly after this, James was arrested as drunk and disorderly in downtown Los Angeles. The following year, in May 1906, he was arrested in a major raid on Sawtelle blind pigs. Further serious problems loomed. Inside the home, Nicholas was deteriorating. The old fellow had been born in North Carolina in 1818 and was almost 90 years old. The letters to the Pioneer Society in San Bernardino had lessened, as did visits to the home from his old contacts in Colton and San Bernardino. He was placed in the home hospital. Judge Earp was near death. The end came for Nicholas Porter Earp on February 12th, when arterial sclerosis proved too much for the father of the Earp boys. There were quite a few obituaries, or at least death notices, for Nicholas P. Earp, especially in the press of California and Arizona. A typical report appeared in the Santa Monica Outlook of February 14th, stating that he was considered an esteemed, exemplary member by his associates, both in Barrick and later in the hospital. And being polite and not mentioning blind pigs, the Outlook mentioned that one son, James Earp, lives in Sawtelle near the home. "Too bad that about Wyatt," they wrote. "Another, Nathan, is in the Searchlight Mining District." Brother James's last stand. Seemingly, James Earp adjusted well to his new life in Sawtelle. After returning from Nome with Wyatt, he headed to San Francisco, while Wyatt opted to open a saloon in Tonopah, Nevada. In 1901, though, James shifted his pension payments to Sawtelle, as he had decided to throw in his lot with that community, knowing his father Nicholas and brother Newton intended to move to the soldiers' home. Although his specific location is not known when Wyatt visited him in Sawtelle in 1903, James was declared the veteran clubman of North 4th Street. As maps of Sawtelle indicate, this was the gaming part of town. Those of us familiar with Father Nicholas's personality don't need documentation to accept that Nick would encourage his fellow veterans to stop in and say hello to Jimmy on the way into town. Nick and his boys were tight as glue. And the first few years he was in the soldier's home, Nick was his usual self-assertive role. He needed to be noticed. As soon as he was enrolled in the home, he was appointed a delegate to the Los Angeles County Democratic Convention. His letters to the Pioneer Society were usually reprinted and the San Bernardino Sun. He was former president of the group. This was the kind of fellow on the home inside that we can conclude was pushing Jim Earp's whiskey and card activities in Sawtell. Wyatt and Virgil visited Los Angeles with their wives several times during this era. Sometimes they were hosted by Brother James, and a few newspaper articles indicated that they also went to the Hollenbeck Hotel. The Hollenbeck was owned and operated by their former Tombstone acquaintance and staunch ally, Albert Clay, A.C. Chris Blicky, who had owned Tombstone's Cosmopolitan Hotel, along with his father, Carl Gustav Gus Blicky. Blicky had backed the Earp brothers after their legendary O.K. Corral gunfight, testifying at the Spicer hearings that Tom McLaurie appeared to have a gun visible in his pants pocket just prior to the altercation. Virgil spent a significant amount of time in Sawtell in 1902 and 1903. The Earps had an especially fine reunion in Los Angeles in 1903, where Blicky entertained many of the family members. He even made a special effort to go and collect Nicholas from the home so he could join Wyatt, James, Virgil, and their wives, as well as sister Adelia and her husband. It is also most likely that Newton was part of the get-together. Adelia praised the doings of Blicky, who had set aside a comfortable green room for the occasion. The tenor of the meeting can be gathered from Adelia's report of Virgil's booming voice. "Dealey, pour some coffee now, and put some of that there whiskey in." Where was Wyatt? On September 6, 1903, the Herald published a letter critical of the Earps, in particular of Wyatt Earp. The phrase, "bad man of other days," was part of the headline, and the article included absurd Earp doings in Dawson and other Klondike places that no Earp had ever known. In response, in the Herald edition of September 9th, George W. Parsons vigorously defended the Earps, ridiculing the "bad men" usage, and pointing out that the Earps had been peace officers, defending and enforcing the law in the face of death. Parsons had known the Earps in Tombstone, had ridden in posses with them, and was still in contact with the family. This incident was clarified in the Parsons diary entry of September 19th, 1903, when he wrote that he had a good swim at Santa Monica. He also met with Wyatt Earp, who thanked me for my defense of him. "He has killed a few, but they ought to have been killed, and he did a good job." This information from Parsons suggests that Wyatt Earp was in the environs of Santa Monica and Sawtell on a visit to his dad and brothers James, Virgil, and Newton. There was never any indication that Wyatt was interested in having any role in the Sawtell operations. He and other investors had opened a Nevada saloon, the Northern, on February 8, 1902. He seemingly did everything right, brought in new bar equipment, and advertised in the appropriately named newspaper, the Tonopah Bonanza. The Northern was two buildings away from the Miners' Exchange Hall. Wyatt's hopes had been so high that he had even planned a stage line between Tonopah and Ray. Few things, though, worked out well for Wyatt and Josie in Tonopah. In fact, Josie spent most of her Nevada time visiting with her relatives in Oakland and San Francisco. Wyatt not only failed in Tonopah, but he quit Nevada and shifted to Arizona territory. He opted for the near desert, and he was soon in Cibola in Yuma County, running a small ranch. This was some miles southwest of Quartzsite, Arizona. And in November 1904, Wyatt was elected the local constable with fewer than a dozen votes cast. Ranching was booming, and by mid-1905, Wyatt was in the Whipple Mountains working a copper mine claim in the fall, winter, and spring months, living in various locations about Los Angeles in the summer. Mining would occupy most of his time until his death on January 13th, 1929. In 1906, while living in the Hampton Arms Hotel in Los Angeles, Wyatt met a young John H. Flood, who would become a loyal friend and have a huge influence throughout the rest of his life and thereafter, and his wife's Josie's until her own death in 1944. Flood attempted to write Wyatt's biography for publication. The attempt failed, but did eventually lead to Stuart Lake's seminal 1931 book, Wyatt Earp, Frontier Marshal, published shortly after Wyatt's death. Lake's book, along with Walter Noble Burns' 1927 classic, Tombstone, An Iliad of the Southwest, were the basis for subsequent Hollywood Earp movies, including 1993's influential Tombstone. It was also John Flood, who died in 1958, who in the early 1950s was tracked down by tenacious historian-collector John Giltrice and subsequently passed on to him many firsthand stories of Wyatt and the Earps, and many of Wyatt and Josie's personal possessions and letters. Many of these are currently in the collection of author David DeHaas. By 1905, 3,200 members were reportedly living in the Sawtelle Soldiers' Home. On October 19th of that same year, Virgil died of pneumonia in Goldfield, Nevada. On February 12, 1907, Nicholas Earp died in the Soldiers' Home Hospital and was buried in the adjacent cemetery, currently known as the Los Angeles National Cemetery. And in 1908, James Earp appears to have been living once more in the San Bernardino area of Southern California. In 1909, brother Newton Earp moved to Oakland, Northern California, to live with his daughter Alice, effectively ending the legendary Fighting Earp family's final endeavor together, bootlegging Los Angeles, Santa Monica, and the old Soldiers' Home. True West, November 2022 edition. The Winner by Max Boardman. Joseph Glidden's invention won the West. In the fall of 1873, Joseph Glidden did what many farmers did and do. He went to the county fair. In this case, it was the DeKalb County, Illinois, due west of Chicago and south of Rockford. For Glidden, the annual fair turned out to be life-changing. He saw an invention created by another local farmer. Fencing that featured metal barbs sticking out of a thin wooden rail. The barbs created an incentive for cattle to stay away from the fence and remain in the enclosure. But it was a bit flimsy. The wood could be costly and had to be cut to demand, often shipped long distances. Joseph Glidden thought there was a better way. So he went back home and tested various ideas, using the barbs as the centerpiece. It took about a year, but he eventually came up with something that is now commonplace around the world, barbed wire. Glidden's invention, the patent was granted on November 24, 1874, used two intertwined strands of wire to hold the barbs in place. It was easy and inexpensive to manufacture. Repairs and replacements were simple. Glidden referred to this model as the Winner. And depending on who you were, it was just that, or not. It wasn't good for many Indian tribes, who were used to traveling through various western regions without any problem. It wasn't good for cattle drives, which required open ranges for travel. And that limited the number of cowboys needed to handle a herd. It wasn't particularly good for wildlife, like buffalo and deer, who could no longer move unfettered. But it was great for farmers and ranchers, especially those with smaller operations. Barbed wire fences provided a distinct demarcation of their properties. And for those running varied operations, it kept the cattle from getting into the crops. The West would never be the same. Increased and improved settlement changed the very nature of the land, and Joseph Glidden was the real winner. But perhaps his true genius was in marketing. He hired sales agents throughout the country, people with local ties who could connect with their neighbor farmers and ranchers. In Texas, Glidden and his state rep, Henry Sanborn, bought and fenced 135,000 acres of range in the Panhandle. 15,000 head of cattle were brought in, and what became known as the Frying Pan Ranch was a big success. Cattlemen across the West saw what could be done and fenced their own properties, and Glidden's fortunes continued to grow. By the time his license expired in the 1890s, it's estimated that he had made more than $1 million. Good investments increased the fortune. But such success breeds competition and legal issues. Two other farmers who had attended that same 1873 county fair had come up with their own barbed wire concepts. They challenged Glidden's patent, and the case took years to move through the justice system. Finally, in 1892, the Supreme Court ruled in Glidden's favor. For the rest of his life, Glidden ran a small business empire from his farm in Illinois. He had been a civic leader well before the invention of barbed wire, and that never changed. He showed a great interest in education. Glidden served briefly as a teacher before going into farming. In 1898, he gave 63 acres of his homestead to help start Northern Illinois State Normal School, later renamed Northern Illinois University. Glidden saw all the changes by the time he died at age 93 in 1906. He's buried in DeKalb's Fairview Cemetery. No, there's no fence around him or the mausoleum that holds his remains. True West, November 2022 edition. This story, this short article, is about a group that I don't normally think about, a place I don't normally think about when I think of the Old West and of cowboys. This article is titled Aloha Cowboys by Jana Bomersback, Hawaii's Paniolo Preservation Society keeps the Old West alive in the 50th state. Here's a Cliff's Notes history of the cowboy. The first were the Spanish vaqueros. The second were the Hawaiian Paniolos. The third were the boys in the Old West. The most remarkable thing about that sentence is that Hawaiians didn't even know what a bovine looked like until six cows and a bull were gifted to their king in 1793. And horses? Not until four were gifted by a Western ship captain in 1803. Yet their cowboy culture was thriving by the mid-1800s, when the Old West started popularizing the image of a wrangling man. It grew out of necessity. King Kamehameha, I prohibited the hunting or killing of cows, so that they not only flourished, but became a dangerous nuisance. They rampaged through villages, eating the thatch off the roofs and destroying crops. By the time his grandson became king, it was time to call in the vaqueros, which Kamehameha III did in 1832, bringing over three Mexican cowboys from California. They first taught the islanders how to break horses to turn them into working animals, and then how to round up all those cattle. The Hawaiian cowboys called themselves Paniolo, a corruption of Español, the Spanish language the vaqueros spoke. They created a unique culture with their own gear, their own saddles, made from a fallen nanelu tree, Hawaiian sumac, carved and covered with rawhide, and songs accompanied by ukulele and guitar. They learned quickly, and their skills were awesome. In 1908, at the biggest rodeo in the world, Cheyenne's Frontier Days, three Paniolos came to compete, wearing flower leis on their hats. They were led by Aikua Purdy. In the World Championship Finals, Purdy won the steer roping contest in 56 seconds. Purdy defeats all comers, the headline read, while the other Paniolos took third and sixth places. A Hawaiian newspaper bragged that the win showed America that the Hawaiian Islands are something more than a hula platform in the middle of the Pacific. More bragging rights came as Hawaiian ranches grew. The oldest and most famous is the Parker Ranch, which started out as 2 acres in the mid-1800s and grew to the largest ranch under individual ownership in the United States, with 225,000 acres and 50,000 cattle. Its frontier was a Massachusetts sailor named John Palmer Parker, who settled in Hawaii in 1815. He started his small ranch after he married Chiefess Kelly and greatly expanded it with her 640-acre inheritance. Their descendants kept expanding. Earlier this year, in honor of the Parker Ranch's 175th anniversary, their Pukalani Stables in Kamuela were gifted to the Paniolo Preservation Society. The society had been leasing the stables since it was founded in 1998 and developed a museum that welcomes visitors from all over the world, notes director Justina Wood. Here, people can see the whole history and accomplishments of the Paniolos. True West Magazine, November 2022 edition. This is a wonderful story that it's a short article about someone who we are very familiar with in the Permian Basin. What History Has Taught Me, Patrick Deeren, by True West Magazine. Inducted into the Texas Literary Hall of Fame with the class of 2022, Patrick Deeren of Midland, Texas, is the author of 16 novels and 10 nonfiction books. His nonfiction is focused on the Pecos and Devil's Rivers, while his books, drawn from his 76 interviews with pre-1932 cowboys, document the last generation of cowhands before mechanization. In 2015, he received the Spur Award of the Western Writers of America for his novel, The Big Drift. I was fortunate to grow up in the West Texas town of Sterling City, which had only 700 residents. Everyone knew everyone else. And when difficulties struck a family, the entire town turned out to support and uplift. I was blessed with parents who provided a nurturing home and taught me Christian values. When my mother gave me Edgar Rice Burroughs' Tarzan of the Apes at age 10, it set me on course to become a writer. "You're a man of words," my father once told me. When I was 14, my English teacher, Bob Bass, returned a book report to me with a note that suggested I consider writing as a career. He gave me what everyone needs, a dream. My 6 years as a reporter gave me the foundation for my books. Two of my novels, When Cowboys Die and The Illegal Man, grew directly out of my newspaper work. Nothing beats a good meal in the wilderness. I remember a Thanksgiving meal in the backcountry of Big Bend National Park, where a can of corn and a pear surpassed any turkey dinner I ever had. I write because I have to, in order to feel right about myself. But whatever I may or may not achieve as a writer, the important thing is to leave a legacy of integrity, honor, and faith. I've been fortunate to live near a world-class research facility, the Haley Memorial Library and History Center in Midland, Texas. The Haley has provided material for 11 of my books. At age 16, I dreamed of winning the Spur Award of Western Writers of America, as had one of my writing idols, Lee Brackett. It took 48 years, but I finally achieved my dream in 2015 for The Big Drift. No one was more dedicated to his job than a cowboy. Indeed, a herd's owner would abandon the cattle and retreat to the wagon long before a cowboy would even consider it. Barbecue is fine, but the beans are better. I can still taste my grandmother's pinto beans from decades ago in Sterling City. The Western is a uniquely American genre, and the cowboy may be, as some have said, our only authentic myth. Although I've written 10 books about the Pecos, I know enough about the river to realize that I don't know anything about it. Few places are more beautiful or have as violent a history as the Devil's River, a Texas tributary of the Rio Grande. I devoted to my history work, Devil's River, Treacherous Twin to the Pecos, 1535 to 1900. Ultimately, the Devils provided the background for my novel, The Big Drift. West Texas is home. When a stranger asked why some stretches of West Texas are so void of traffic, a longtime resident explained that everybody's already where he wants to be. Many readers would never pick up a documented history work. Historical fiction, however, holds the promise of engaging a reader through a character or characters. Twice, I've hiked the 14 miles between two legendary points on the Goodnight Loving Trail, Castle Gap and Horsehead Crossing. An understanding of geography is vital to an understanding of history. I write my novels on my daily walks and during my wilderness hikes. I average 35 WPM, or words per mile. For The Big Drift, I put in 1,850 miles. What history has taught me. Did anything really happen? Or did everything really happen? Considering how sources invariably contradict one another, sorting out truth is a fascinating journey.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.